Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 31st of October 2015. Welcome to the show. My name's Hereward Fenton. I'll be with you for the next hour. And today I'm going to be focusing on what I see as the key indicators of a decline in US power and influence in the world. And I might speculate a little as to what that's going to lead to, what types of changes we're going to see in the near future, because I really do believe that the United States has reached its peak, a while ago in terms of its power in the world. And we are now seeing the downward trend. But, of course, there's going to be a lot of ups and downs before you really get a clear indication of what's happening. But I believe that in the future, when we look back on this time, we'll see it as the turning point, and we'll see that that US power began to decline around about now, probably from a few years ago, really, but it starts to become more and more apparent now. And I just want to run through a few stories which really illustrate this from a number of different perspectives. And we've got multiple indicators now that the United States is simply not able to carry its weight to basically bully and bludgeon its way to get its policy objectives in place. We have reports from the Pacific, where the China naval chief says a minor incident could spark a war in the South China Sea, and that's as a result of, as China claims, U.S. Ships violating China's territorial waters by sailing through the Spratly's Islands. And they're quite unabashedly saying that if the U.S. keeps doing this, there's going to be a conflict. Now, this never would have happened a few years ago. This is an indicator that China has a new level of confidence and basically is quite willing to provoke an incident, or quite willing to allow an incident to be provoked and to go to that length of actually saying, well, we'll be firing back if this happens again. We have in Vienna this conference that is designed to find a solution to the problems in Syria, and 19 global powers are involved in finding a new solution to the problems in Syria. Now, this new group, of course, does involve the United States, but the United States is only a player in this. They're only a participant. And the statements that the US has been making ever since the beginning of the Syrian conflict, that Assad has to go, are starting to seem more and more ridiculous. I mean, I've got an article here from RT.com, and under the heading, Should Assad Go?, it says here, the fate of Bashar Assad remained a stumbling block throughout the seven-hour meeting. The US and its allies, including Saudi Arabia, believe that the Syrian president, whose term expires in 2021, must resign. There is no way President Assad can unite and govern Syria, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, adding that Syrians deserve a different choice. Kerry also told the journalists that the U.S. is employing a two-part approach in Syria, intensifying the counter-terror campaign and intensifying our diplomatic efforts to end the conflict. Now, at the same time as this, Russia's Foreign Minister Lavrov stressed that it is up to the Syrian people to make decisions such as whether Assad will stay in power. I'm just returning to Kerry's statement here. Kerry had said that Assad could stay in power for a few more months during the period of transition, but he insisted he must step down when it draws to a close. And the Russians are now saying the Syrian people should define the future of their country, including Assad's fate. And of course, this is the voice of logic, common sense, and decency. And the American position increasingly seems like the position of an aggressive bully. Because understand, the demands for Assad to step down are unilateral and unconditional, and they're not tied to any specific war crimes charges against Assad. There have been allegations made against Assad's regime, but there are no warrants outstanding for him. Of course, you know, to compare this, for example, with Yugoslavia, where Slobodan Milosevic, the head of state of Yugoslavia, was in the end brought before the International Criminal Court. There is nothing currently, there is no legal judicial process. There are no specific charges against Bashar al-Assad. So American demands in this case are simply an expression of their attitude, an expression of this is what we want, this should happen. And then when they're confronted over it, well, they say, well, you know, that's the best thing that could happen, or you know, that's for the greater good. But they can't even really articulate why they're saying that. Of course, anyone who studies the geopolitics of the region knows why they're saying it, because they want to remove Syria as a bulwark, Syria as an ally of Russia and as an enemy of Israel is a problem for those who are still trying to resuscitate the global hegemony that represents America, Israel, and its European cohorts. But even the Europeans now are not towing the line. There's a big indication that the EU is starting to move away from a tight alliance with the United States. Unlike Australia, unfortunately, Australia still is deeply enmeshed, and our media and our general population are deeply sort of hypnotized by the talking points and the propaganda memes of the US empire. But in Europe, things are changing. And this particular story I just want to share with you about Edward Snowden is a really good indicator of that. And this is from the European Parliament, European Parliament News. Mass surveillance. EU citizens' rights still in danger, says the Parliament. Too little has been done to safeguard citizens' fundamental rights following revelations of electronic mass surveillance, say MEPs, in a resolution voted on Thursday. They urge the EU Commission to ensure that all data transfers to the US are subject to an effective level of protection. And they ask EU member states to grant protection to Edward Snowden as a human rights defender. Now, this position on Edward Snowden is very, very significant, because understand, in the United States, he is being regarded as a common criminal. And he is charged under the Espionage Act. And if convicted, he would be probably locked up in prison for the rest of his life. And there is no grey area in terms of the US position, even though he has a lot of support within the United States, the government, and this would be the same under any government. Currently, this is the Democrat government. If a conservative government came into power, it would be equally or even more aggressive in terms of the way they would be chasing Edward Snowden. So this new resolution in Europe really is very significant, ladies and gentlemen. The resolution, approved by 342 votes to 274 with 29 abstentions, takes stock of the lack of action taken by the European Commission, other EU institutions and member states on the recommendations set out by the Parliament in its resolution of 12 March 2014 on the electronic mass surveillance of EU citizens, drawn up in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations. By 285 votes to 281, MEPs decided to call on EU member states to drop any criminal charges against Edward Snowden, grant him protection, and consequently prevent extradition or rendition by third parties in recognition of his status as a whistleblower and an international human rights defender. Concerns over surveillance laws in several EU countries. Parliament is concerned about recent laws in some member states that extend surveillance capabilities of intelligence bodies, including in France, the UK, and the Netherlands. It is also worried by revelations of mass surveillance of telecommunications and internet traffic inside the EU by the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, BND, in cooperation with the US National Security Agency. So as you can see, there is a changing of the tide in relations towards the US. Now, while all that's happening, increasingly under scrutiny are the actions of United States military, events such as the bombing of the hospital in Kunduz, and a new attention now being put on the pure illegality and the horrific nature of the US drone strike program, with a new whistleblower having come forward who appears to be of the same ilk as Edward Snowden, and there is a huge tranche of information which he has supplied, which has been investigated by The Intercept, led by Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill. And in the next section, I just want to play to you a little from the recent interview that that Jeremy Scahill gave on Democracy Now! And recently there's been another hospital bombing, ladies and gentlemen, in Yemeni, and this is under the Saudi-led coalition, which has extensive support from the US. And another Médecins Sans Frontières hospital has been bombed in Yemen. And, of course, Yemen has been the focus of drone strikes as well. And so all this negative PR about the United States is really taking off as well, just as we see the Russians and the Chinese taking initiative, showing high level of confidence and really unconcern about what America might do. And we have Russia in Syria right now. We have America saying that they will be sending ground troops into Syria. And the Russians aren't concerned about that at all. So I'll continue with more of this analysis when we come back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I would just like to read to you a little now from an article from the ABC, ABC Australia. The United States is to send ground troops to Syria as world powers meet to discuss the crisis. So we have, to me this is another indicator that the US is a little out of control and it's acting erratically. I believe there's probably a lack of unity even within the policymakers, within the Pentagon, within the government, as to what they need to be doing, because they know they're losing grip of the situation. So at the same time as engaging in these conferences, they're also acting quite aggressively. Now, they try to defend that as like an intentional position, but it is actually a sign that they have lost control. The United States has announced its first sustained deployment of ground troops to Syria, saying a small special forces team would assist the anti-jihadist fight as major powers met in Vienna, seeking a political solution to the war. The deployment marks an escalation in Washington's efforts to defeat the Islamic State, which has tightened its grip on swathes of Syria, despite more than a year of US-led airstrikes. Officials said President Barack Obama had authorized an initial deployment of fewer than 50 special forces in northern Syria, parts of which are controlled by Syrian Kurdish forces fighting IS, easing his long-standing refusal to put boots on the ground. Now, let's just reflect for a moment on the real meaning of this. You've got to realize that whenever something is put out into the news, the question of why it was released as news is as important as the facts themselves, because it's all about manipulating perceptions. Now, of course, anyone who studied this, anyone who knows anything about this conflict knows that the US has had covert operatives, I'm sure more than 50, in Syria already for many years, and they have been assisting the rebels, the jihadis, basically assisting anyone who is trying to bring down Assad, and they've been funneling money. And this has been the American approach, and that was the way the American foreign policy framed it, because that's how they like to do things, right? Because they believe they have so much power. They believe they are so ubiquitously influential that they have so much resources and so much ability that they can infiltrate other countries and bring them down and do it without their footprint even being recognized. But it didn't work, you see. It didn't work. The covert technique that has worked so many times for them didn't work. And that is another indicator of the fact that the US influence is no longer as strong as it was. They still have a lot of money, they still have a lot of arms, they still have a lot of power in that sense. But there are other players on the field too who also have money, power, and influence. And they can't succeed simply through doing these covert, dirty ops that they have used in the past. And that's clearly the case. It's not working. And they have been outwitted. They've been outplayed by Russia in the diplomatic area, because Russia has consistently upheld international law, has actually gotten involved in the conflict in a way that respects the sovereignty of Syria, while not supporting tyranny. They've never specifically said they support dictatorial regimes, but what they've said is they want the Syrian government to be able to maintain its sovereignty so that they can deal with the extreme problem, which is the insurgency. And in doing so, they uphold international law. They're not violating Syria's sovereignty. So they've made the United States look very bad already by doing that, and weakened the prestige of the United States. So I believe policymakers within the US government have been a bit outplayed here and been a bit wrong-footed. And now they're trying to recover the situation, and they're trying to play the diplomatic game. So they think, well, we'll get some brownie points by engaging in this sort of diplomacy. But you know what? What we're best at is force. So now we're going to put boots on the ground in Syria, and that's going to show the world that we, you know, we really are in charge. We're the tough guys. You know, we're the boss. Well, look, that's not going to work either. And it makes them look inconsistent, and they won't be able to risk a real conflict with the Russian forces. They need to be very, very careful, because they have aircraft and now admittedly ground troops. If they start directly conflicting with the Russian objectives in Syria, this could easily lead to a military conflict with Russia. So we now have the United States at risk of a military conflict with Russia in Syria, and also at risk of a military conflict with China in the Spratly Islands. And let me just return to that article in relation to the Pacific, because again, this is equally important, and it shows the United States kind of caught between the pincers here, and their position is becoming much, much more difficult to maintain. China's naval commander told his US counterpart that a minor incident could spark war in the South China Sea if the United States did not stop its provocative acts in the disputed waterway. Admiral Wu Shengli made the comments to the US Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral John Richardson, during a video teleconference on Thursday, according to a Chinese naval statement. And this is an article from MSN, and doesn't seem to have a date on it. MSN, April, no, that can't be right. Okay, that's a stock photo. It says April 22nd, 2014, but there's no date on the article. Odd. Anyway, this is an article very, very recent, within the last couple of days. The two officers held talks after a US warship sailed within 12 nautical miles of one of Beijing's man-made islands in the contested Spratly Archipelago on Tuesday. Sorry, this is actually a Reuters news feed, and it is from one day ago. So that is from the 30th of October. It's a Reuters news feed on MSN.com. China has rebuked Washington over the patrol. The most significant U.S. challenge yet to territorial limits, China effectively claims, around its seven artificial islands in one of the world's busiest sea lanes. If the United States continues with these kinds of dangerous, provocative acts, there could well be a seriously pressing situation between frontline forces from both sides on the sea and in the air, or even a minor incident that sparks war. I hope the U.S. side cherishes the good situation between the Chinese and U.S. navies that has not come easily, and avoids these kind of incidents from happening again. A U.S. Navy spokesman stressed Washington's position that U.S. freedom of navigation operations were meant to protect the rights, freedoms, and lawful uses of the sea and airspace guaranteed to all nations under international law. Now, again, this comes across as the U.S. just trying too hard, you know, trying to strut their stuff and not really succeeding. It basically just highlights the fact, I believe, that America's influence is now on the way. We're going to break. We'll be right back after this very, very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And our theme today is American power on the wane. And I'm just going through a number of news stories, trying to connect a few dots and see the big picture, because it's often hard to see it. And when you look back is when you'll see it. 10 years' time, you look back. 20 years' time, the further ahead in time you are from now, the more clear it will be what actually was happening right now. And another aspect of this waning of American influence is the increased scrutiny on American war crimes, on extreme violations of international law and the laws of war. And none is more shocking than the drone program, which of course has been in place since the events of September 11, 2001. That was around about the time when the drone strikes began, and they increased during the Bush era, and then they increased even more during the Obama term. And it has always been just really, really shocking, really horrifying to me to know that this is going on, to know that it is such criminal behavior, it is such a violation, it is just unconscionable what has been taking place. And there is more and more attention on it, and of course a recent whistleblower has come forward, who Edward Snowden has indicated is probably the most important person so far since he came forward to reveal information of this nature. And I've got an article here, a recent article from The Intercept, on the legality of these drone strikes. American drone assassinations may violate international law, experts say. The standards governing America's drone assassinations may violate the Geneva Conventions and other international norms, legal experts say. U.S. forces routinely classify bystanders felled in its Afghanistan drone strikes as enemies killed in action, even when they are not the intended targets of the strikes, according to a source and to documents obtained by The Intercept. But the Geneva Conventions specify that when someone's status is not clear, they should be classified as a civilian. Article 50 of Additional Protocol 1, which dates to 1977 and was ratified by 174 countries, says that in case of doubt whether a person is a civilian, that person shall be considered to be a civilian. A landmark document from the International Committee of the Red Cross in 2009 expands on this rule. All feasible precautions must be taken in determining whether a person is a civilian, and if so, whether that civilian is directly participating in hostilities. In case of doubt, the person must be presumed to be protected against direct attack. In case of doubt as to whether a specific civilian conduct qualifies as direct participation in hostilities, it must be presumed that the general rule of civilian protection applies. The US failed to ratify Protocol 1 after signing it, and the Red Cross's legal guidance has been controversial. But until now, it's been unclear to what extent the US would depart from treaties and other influential documents related to classifying casualties whose civilian status is unclear. The controversial US posture towards possible civilians is not confined to its drone wars or to the documents obtained by The Intercept. It's also explicitly outlined in a landmark law of war manual issued by the Department of Defense in June. The manual, the first ever such department-wide manual in the DoD's history and the culmination of years of legal deliberation, directly addresses Additional Protocol 1, but argues that customary international law does not require classifying people as civilians by default. A legal presumption of civilian status in cases of doubt may demand a degree of certainty that would not account for the realities of war, the document states. It also claims that under customary international law, no legal presumption of civilian status exists for persons or objects. So that's an article up on The Intercept just a couple of days ago by Murtaza Hussein. I want to now play a little from an interview on Democracy Now with Jeremy Scahill, who is part of the team who is working on the information that was supplied by this whistleblower who has come forward. And he is talking here to Amy Goodman on the 16th of October. Here we go.
Well, you know, the first drone strike outside of a declared war zone happened in November of 2002 in Yemen. And in that strike, it was a CIA operation with the military, and the whole thing was coordinated out of a command center in Washington, D.C. And in that strike, actually, six people were killed, including an American citizen. And at the time, Condoleezza Rice, you know, senior official in the Bush administration, was defending the right of the President of the United States to assassinate individuals, including U.S. citizens, based on intelligence that they never had to make public. There wasn't another drone strike in Yemen until 2011, 2012, the Obama administration really starts to intensify drone operations in Yemen. Despite the fact that at times Pakistan was being bombed once every 3 days by drones, you had an active drone program in Afghanistan, it wasn't until May of 2013 that a sitting U.S. president gave an official address where he acknowledged that, you know, drones were being used by the United States. I mean, it was sort of a farcical, you know, scenario where you'd have the president making jokes about killing the Jonas Brothers at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. He would talk about it on a YouTube or on a Google Hangout in response to questions from people talking to the president. But they never really fully owned this thing in public. What we've published is an extensive look into how this program has operated historically, but specifically under President Obama. One of the most significant findings of this, and my colleague Cora Currier really dug deep into this, is we published for the first time the kill chain, what the bureaucracy of assassination looks like. And what you see is that all of these officials, including people like the Treasury Secretary, are part of signing off on all of this, at where they have these secret meetings. And they discuss who's going to live and die around the world. And at the end of that process, it is the President of the United States who signs what amounts to a death warrant for whoever they've decided should die based on what amounts to a parallel secret judicial system in the United States that is not really subjected to any kind of judicial review, where the president acts sort of as emperor, issues an edict that you die. And what we show, and this is the first time that there's documentary evidence of this, is that the president gives the military a 60-day window to hunt down and kill these individuals. Ken Roth from Human Rights Watch pointed out today, if the standard is that the people who are being targeted for assassination is that they represent an imminent threat, which is what the president says the U.S. policy is, then why do they have 60 days to do it? Why don't they need to do it now if it's imminent? Well, that's because they've redefined the term imminent to be so vague as to not even resemble its actual commonly understood definition.
And Jeremy, one of the things that struck me is your finding that so much of the information upon which they base these attacks is based on signals intelligence, not real live intelligence or stuff that they've gleaned from other people they've interrogated, and the unreliability of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, and this, you know, really we know so much more about this because of the Edward Snowden leaks, but so much of the entire intelligence industrial complex in the, you know, sort of in the U.S. empire is dependent upon intercepting people's emails, their text messages, their phone calls, and you know, signals intelligence can be reliable. I mean, if I'm talking to you, Juan, they can do our voice recognition. They can say, okay, we know that Jeremy Scahill's talking to Juan Gonzalez. But when...
We're just going to break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. I'm just playing to you a clip there of Jeremy Scahill talking about the drone program. Be right back for one more segment after the break. Do stay with us.
in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm just going to continue playing a clip here from Democracy Now!, a very interesting interview with Jeremy Scahill, where he's talking about the history of the drone program and the mechanisms within the US Defense Department by which these orders are carried out. So just continue here from where we left off.
When you talk to people who really worked in that world, Cora Currier and I interviewed Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who was the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the top official running all of the Pentagon spy operations around the world. And he was Stanley McChrystal's top intelligence guy at JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. When Cora and I spoke to him, he said, look, I can record my voice on a phone and give it to a courier. The courier can go somewhere else. They can call a number and they can play that. And someone's going to die over there and they'll think that they've eliminated this target, but they didn't. And he said signals intelligence is very easy to fool.
I want to go back to a quote from the article. Speaking about the issue of working with bad intelligence, your source said, quote, it requires an enormous amount of faith in the technology you're using. These countless instances where I've come across intelligence that was faulty. It's stunning the number of instances when selectors are misattributed to certain people, and it isn't until several months or years later that you all of a sudden realize the entire time you thought you were going after this really hot target, you wind up realizing it was his mother's phone the whole time.
Right. And what the source is talking about there is that, for the most part, the assassination program is not targeting people. It's targeting their selectors, their cell phone number, the SIM card data that they have, an email train that's littered with metadata that they've now determined is connected to someone. And so I think a lot of the biggest civilian death cases that we have are because they've hit a phone that they think is in possession of, a terrorist or a militant, the vague term that they use. Oops, we blew up the phone, but, that person didn't happen to be there because this sub-commander of the Taliban happened to throw his SIM card into a bag with everybody else's. They shake it up, and this is a tactic that the Taliban use, and then they all go somewhere else. They use it because they know that this is how the U.S., hunts them down and tracks. It's death by metadata, basically.
And even in Afghanistan, where the United States has been occupying the country and has troop boots on the ground in Afghanistan, we're not talking now Yemen, Somalia, right, or some of these other places, your information found that as many as 90% of the intended targets of the people killed were not the intended targets?
Yeah, I mean, I think the piece that if people are sort of thinking about what the president said yesterday and sort of, further extending the longest war in American history to a point where we don't actually see any end in sight. Ryan Devereaux's piece on manhunting in the Hindu Kush is incredible. It looks at a JSOC campaign called Operation Haymaker. And one of the sort of among many sort of amazing revelations in it is that, JSOC claims to be like meticulously surgically hunting down and killing leaders of Al-Qaeda, leaders of the Taliban. And in 1 5-month period in Afghanistan, where they have all the resources, they have the surveillance technology, they have informants on the ground, they have ability to do night raids, to do after action investigations, that 88% of the people that they killed in mostly drone strikes, but some other strikes as well, were not the intended target of the strikes.
Now, I'll just leave it there. It's a very interesting interview, and I'll put a link to that on the show notes. And this further highlights the collapse of the perception of American supremacy. There's a degree of incompetence here, which is just quite striking, as well as being quite heinous and quite evil. There's an element of it which indicates that these people don't really know what they're doing. So I'll just leave that at this point. There's one more topic I want to return to now in relation to, somewhat in relation to this, the question of climate change. And I want to refer to a report that came forward from the New York Times, because this is quite interesting, because I've been scouring the internet trying to see what the Russian position on climate change is. And on the face of it, it appears that the Russian position is climate change alarmist, in the sense that they support emissions reductions, they support the COP21 conference in Paris, and they have made some promises in terms of their reductions of emissions. So on the face of it, you could say, well, the Russians are supportive of carbon reduction programs. But when you burrow into it a little deeper, you see it's not really very consistent. It doesn't have much bite in terms of the policies that they're planning to enact. And now we have an article here that's come forth from the New York Times. Russian media take climate change cue from skeptical Putin. Now it says here, and this is a, bear in mind, this is a New York Times pro-climate change article full of their own kind of spin on it. And I just want to focus in on the key information in the article. So just skipping through some of the paragraphs here where they're talking about Siberia's wildfire problem, and that is definitely indication of climate change, because Siberia's never had wildfires before and suddenly it's got these terrible blazes. Let's just focus in on the key information here. While Western media have examined the role of rising temperatures and drought in this year's record wildfires in North America, a Russian media continue to pay little attention to an issue that animates so much of the world. The indifference reflects widespread public doubt that human activities play a significant role in global warming, a tone set by Vladimir Putin, who has offered only vague and modest pledges of emissions cuts ahead of December's UN climate summit in Paris. Russia's official view appears to have changed little since 2003, when Putin told an international climate conference that warmer temperatures would mean Russians spend less on fur coats, while agricultural specialists say our grain production will increase, and thank God for that. The president believes that there is no global warming, that this is a fraud to restrain the industrial development of several countries, including Russia, says Stanislav Belkovsky, a political analyst and critic of Putin. That is why this subject is not topical for the majority of the Russian mass media and society in general. Now, this is an interesting one for me, because I did not know this, and I'm actually quite pleased to see that Putin has not bought in to the full fraud of climate change, as so many other world leaders have. He is obviously paying lip service to it. He is playing along with it. And it's an article here from joannenova.com.au in which she discusses it. And she's got some commentary here. Bizarrely, Russia may yet slow the train wreck in Paris. The former communist state may be the one to thwart the ambitions of the freeloading global bureaucracy. We can't relax, though, because like the Chinese, Putin will have a price, and if the equation changes so that Russia gains an advantage over the West through generous exemptions or credits or some other trade deal, he'll pay a lip service to the climate extremists. Now, of course, this slap in the face to the global consensus on climate change is another tarnishing of American prestige and reputation. Because, of course, let's not forget, the whole thrust of carbon reduction, emissions trading, carbon pricing, all came from America, and with organizations like the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch heavily supporting it, and individuals like Al Gore being the spokespersons for it, it really is an American concept. But it's all falling apart. And of course, we've seen that this attempt to create a new form of global governance through manipulating public opinion of some impending catastrophe is simply not working to the extent that those behind it believed it would. It's fraying. And if we look at the actual pledges that that countries have made, you can see they're playing games, ladies and gentlemen. They're manipulating words to give the impression of having a position. Russia says it will limit greenhouse gas emissions to 70 to 75% of 1990 levels by 2030. Now, it turns out that 70 to 75% of 1990 levels are still higher than the levels that they had in 2005. Because back in 1990, they had a huge, the Soviet Union was in full force and there was this huge activity going on. So what the Russians are actually saying is they're going to increase emission levels now. Most of the countries are saying they will reduce emissions from the year 2005 level. But Europe is saying it will reduce emissions from 1990 levels. Again, they are playing it. They are playing fancy footwork there with the wording. Anyway, that's our show for this week. I do hope it has been interesting for you, and I will continue to keep my eye on the ball. And if you've got any interesting thoughts or observations, please send me an email via the contact page at Truth News Radio Australia.